From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox.
We all have hope in him, so, you know, we're expecting him to, you know, bring some change. We have no other choice, really. Like, we can't depend on nobody else. Like, he's going to be the new president. He's promised us a lot of things. And, you know, we're hoping he, you know, actually makes them true.
Dragon step and say, step and soul, how we don't stop until we hear the beat drop.
Obama made history. He was telling us that to be good, work hard, and never give up and achieve the stuff that you can do. It is possible.
Drag a step and stay a step and so hard. We don't stop until we hear the beat drop. Drag a step and stay a step and so hard. We don't stop.
Well, to spend the day with all my friends and like my family, because it's important that we all share this this feeling together, that this feeling of joy, because we're going to have a new black president and we know that there's going to be some changes made throughout history now.
I think it's amazing because there's so many people that said it couldn't happen, and it's so amazing. I'm so glad to be here to watch it happen.
Well, as a young African-American male, this have just inspired me, just not just personally, but also to pursue some of the goals that I had in terms of education. And so Barack Obama have shown me personally that, hey, if I work hard, stick to it, that America will be fair.
I think it's a chance to see a miracle that has happened in my lifetime. There's no way that this young gentleman could have come from where he came to become president of the United States in that short amount of time without the hand of God being involved. And I'm just going to be very curious to see where things go from here, but it certainly will not be boring.
Just some of the sounds from President Barack Obama's inauguration yesterday was a defining moment in history. Millions braved the bitter cold in Washington to witness the swearing-in, and millions more joined in the jubilation across the nation and across the globe. We'll have reactions from Kenya and Harlem, but first, we turn to NPR Midwest reporter Cheryl Corley in President Obama's adopted hometown of Chicago. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, how are you, Tony?
I'm fine, thank you. I know you spent the day yesterday in Chicago's Disabled Museum of African American History. Describe that scene for us.
Well, yeah, it's the DuSable Museum, and it's not far from the Obama Chicago home. And it was just really a joyous occasion there. Of course, the museum is a place that's full of history, Tony, about African Americans, so it was special in that sense. There are about 450 people there. That's the seating capacity for the museum auditorium, mostly African-American, but a mixed crowd, mostly older, too. But some parents had brought their children with them, and there were some younger people there. And everyone, it was funny because everybody was paying attention to the announcer in D.C. There was this big screen, video screen in the center of the auditorium. So when the announcer in D.C. told them to stand, they stood and sit, they sat. But, you know, it was just, you know, ecstatic when the ceremony took place. People were pumping their fists in the air, waving American flags, crying. They sang both the national anthem and the black national anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing. And so it was just really a lot of celebrating in that room and a lot of hometown pride.
I wonder, is there any residual fallout at all from the Senator Roland Burris debacle because of Obama's initial opposition to his appointment by the embattled Illinois Governor Blagojevich?
I don't really think so, Tony. There has been so much anticipation here about Barack Obama becoming president, and the Roland Burris matter was resolved when he was seated last Thursday before the inauguration. And I think that that had been the hope of everybody here and probably in D.C., the Senate Democrats, of course, that they could get this whole matter resolved before the inauguration festivities began. Mr. Obama did agree initially with Democrats in Illinois and the Senate Democrats, who called the Burris appointment tainted, since it was made by Illinois Governor Rob Blagojevich, who faces federal corruption charges. But once Mr. Burris became the senator, the president, who was then the president-elect, said, you know, he looks forward to working with the senator and the rest of the Senate as he takes on the country's challenges. So I think everybody here is just glad to see that issue put to rest.
Cheryl, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
That was NPR Midwest reporter Cheryl Corley. She joined us from the NPR studios in Chicago. Now we're going to head east to New York. NPR's Robert Smith spent the day in the raucous Harlem Armory yesterday. He joins us now. How are you doing, Robert?
I'm doing great. And no offense to Cheryl. She's talking about the hometown pride for Barack Obama. They like to point out in Harlem that before he moved to Chicago, Barack Obama went to Columbia University and lived in East Harlem. There you go.
Well, how did they process this spectacle yesterday?
Process is a tame word for it. It was an out-and-out party, everything from giant video screens on 125th Street. There were big events at the Schomburg Center for Black Culture and at the Apollo Theater. I went to a school children event at the Harlem Armory, and if you can imagine the sound of about 5,000 middle school students in a concrete bunker like the Armory screaming at the top of their lungs, you can imagine it not only hurt your ears, but it was a little hard to follow the inauguration with that much excitement in one place.
I wonder whether or not there was any kind of indication, Robert, from these kids that they might become more politically motivated and engaged as a result of the election of Barack Obama.
Well, you know, this entire event was put on by a charter school up there in Harlem called Democracy Prep, and they had taken on the election as an entire module of study. So they did Get Out the Vote, they did campaign events earlier on in the season, and in fact, the kids wanted to go to D.C. They couldn't make it happen, so they decided to organize this mostly themselves, which is amazing. So they were out at 6 in the morning, these middle school students, organizing this gigantic party for all these other schools. So, yeah, they've become a little involved in the political process. They've taken this on as their own.
I appreciate the time that you've given us, Robert. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was NPR correspondent Robert Smith. He joined us from the NPR studios in New York City. Now we're going to head farther east, way farther. Rachel Jones is a former NPR reporter. She is currently on sabbatical in Kenya, where people are paying an unusual amount of attention to the American transfer of power. She joined us now by phone from Nairobi. Rachel, how are you?
I'm doing well.
You helped organize an event there in your adopted city of Nairobi yesterday. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, it was a group of largely American expats, folks who are here for various religious or evangelical reasons, or also working for NGOs and academia. And we wanted to talk about what the election meant to African Americans and to try to bridge the gap of knowledge and understanding between Africans and African Americans, especially in this sort of heightened atmosphere here in Kenya, where President Obama's father was born in the western part of the country.
I want to talk about that a little bit more, because we have seen video from Kogelo, the village where Obama's father was born. There was great jubilation and dancing, and people were wearing shirts and other kinds of clothing with likenesses of Obama on them. My question to you, though, is this. What kind of connection do the people there really feel towards Obama, the son? I mean, for villagers, is having the name enough to claim Obama as a native son?
Well, interestingly enough, there is a sort of a split in feeling between folks over in the western part of the country and certainly near the village where his father was born and folks in Nairobi. I think there's a much more sanguine approach to the connection in Nairobi than there might be the sort of jubilant atmosphere out west. But I think across the board, there is a sense that this is an amazing event and that there is a Kenyan connection. I mean, there's no disputing or denying the fact that his father was born in their country. And so they take the claim as the first African nation to either directly or indirectly produce an American president. So it's just a matter of degrees, I guess, the level of jubilation. But there's a sense of pride throughout the country.
Do you get a feeling, Rachel, that there is a sense that there will be a better relationship between Africa, particularly Kenya and the United States, as a result of Obama's connection there?
There is a lot of discussion about that around the continent, and I think that's tempered with a lot of caution that people are saying, you know, this man was elected president of the United States, not Kenya and not of Africa. So there's a measure of trying to keep a balance there. But in moments of jubilation, there is a sense that this is going to mean a great deal, not only for Africa, but certainly for Kenya. There's a perception that there will be a sense of considering what's going on in African nations, and actually people expecting direct help. So I think that's certainly something that in the first 100 days and certainly in the first 6 months will get sorted out, and people have much more realistic expectation. But people looked at things like Susan Rice being named UN ambassador as a good sign, a good first sign along those lines.
Really quickly, in 10 seconds or less, better than Bush, the relationship, are they expecting it to be with Obama?
I don't think there's anywhere to go but up from there.
Thank you.
Rachel, all across the continent.
Thank you very much. That was Rachel Jones. She is an independent journalist and a Knight Health Fellow with the International Center for Journalists based in Nairobi, Kenya. Today is President Barack Obama's first full day in office, and with wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, a battered economy, and strife in the Middle East, the 44th president has a lot of work on his plate. How will he lead during his first 100 days in the White House and beyond? And some key appointments in his cabinet still have yet to be approved. Will this stall his agenda in his first few days? Here to help break down the day's political news, Mary Frances Berry, back with us again, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Ron Christie, CEO of Christie Strategies. He is also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Mary, you've been working really hard for us this week, and we appreciate your coming back.
All right.
Ron, nice to have you as well. In fact, I'm going to begin with you, Ron, because the inauguration is over, and we're already back in governing mode with the new administration. I've heard some Republicans on the Hill already say, Ron, that they think President Obama is off to a good bipartisan start, sort of. But before we get to that, you were with former President Bush yesterday. What can you tell us about his mood as he departed the White House?
Well, I did get the opportunity to spend some time with the president yesterday, the 43rd president of the United States yesterday, and his spirits were high. He was in a very good mood, somewhat reflective about his time in office, but very much looking forward to going home to Texas, spending time with his family, and moving on to the next chapter in his life. But a very wistful day for him, a day that he was very proud to return, as he said yesterday, to his favorite title, which is Citizen Bush, Citizen of the United States.
I know that it's a secret, but I'm just wondering, did he happen to share with you the contents of the note that he left in the desk of the Oval Office for the new coming president?
Sorry, Tony. No, that is only something that the outgoing president gives to the incoming president, and they don't share even to staff that they know and like.
All right. Well, Mary, let's move on to this. Closing Guantanamo Bay prison camp, pulling troops out of Iraq, pushing through an economic stimulus package, lifting the restrictions on stem cell research. These are just some of the items on the new president's agenda. I'm going to ask you which tasks should be at the top of his priority list in your opinion, although, Mary, it seems like he has already moved on Guantanamo, ordering a cessation of prosecutions for the next 4 months until May 20th.
Yes. Well, what he ordered was a cessation until the review is completed in May. And the review, we don't know where it'll end. It could end with more military commissions, or it could end with having the cases in regular courts. As for closing Guantanamo, he has already stated that it's going to take some time to do that. It's not easy figuring out what to do with the people who are there and whether to drop charges, have them detained somewhere else. His first item, he already started with the stimulus package before he was inaugurated, asking Congress to pass it, and there is a bill up there. We don't know the shape of it and what it will be in the end, so he's already gotten a head start on that. The other items on his agenda, he hasn't turned to stem cells yet, but if you look at the website, the new White House website, you will see all the things from the transition website are listed there, everything from ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell to you name it. It's all listed there. We've gone used to talking about the first 100 days of the presidency since Franklin Roosevelt, and every president does that. Clinton did it. Jimmy Carter tried it, their first 100 days. There's no urgency that everything has to be done in 100 days, but we all keep track of it. The first thing he has to tackle, though, is the economy.
Is the economy.
In my view.
Right.
Yes.
Let me ask you this, Ron Christie, because he won't be able to do anything without bipartisan support on Capitol Hill, and he's making good on his campaign promises so far to work with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel reportedly making routine calls already to members of Congress from the Republican Party. Congressional Republicans are trying to get a meeting with him, him being Obama, this week to give their thoughts on a Democratic stimulus package. My question for you is this: how much of an issue is it for the Republicans to, on one hand, cooperate with the new administration, but on the other, maintain a political distance at the same time?
Well, I think Republicans on Capitol Hill want to find common ground with the new president and the new president's team and find areas of interest for the American people. I mean, they've all been elected to do the people's business and to make sure that this country is kept safe, to make sure that the economy gets going again. And so I do think that congressional Republicans are very eager to sit down with the president to talk about their views for an economic stimulus package. And again, as I said from the outset, to find common ground. I think Republicans will only oppose the new president when they find ideological differences of opinion. But I think all Republicans and all Americans want this this new president to succeed, and so I think that we're going to reach out with a strong spirit of bipartisanship and see what we can do on behalf of the American people.
Yeah, but
Mary,
Tony, it's
also true that members of Congress are usually very timid about taking on a president of the opposite party as long as his popularity is high. When Reagan came in and he had very high popularity ratings, the Democratic House wasn't willing to take him on anything until he had a few stumbles, and he didn't have that many. It's the same thing with the president each time. And now with Obama, you have the added factor of the singular nature of his presidency. So I don't think the Republicans will give him a great deal of trouble until he actually slips in, you know, the polling data or has some misstep or other.
Well, yeah, but what about the, and that was going to be my question to you, Mary, what about alienating congressional Democrats, those on the left who think perhaps some of his centrist views are not what they signed up for?
Well, I think that some will be alienated. Some will worry more when they get closer to 2 years from now when they're running for reelection based on their own promises. But I think the criticism will be muted, one, by his popularity, two, as they focus on the economy, things are so bad that most people up there will go along with whatever is being proposed in the end with some face-saving measures here and there for the Blue Dogs, for example, just because everybody wants something to happen and nobody really knows exactly what to do.
Let's talk about foreign policy for a moment. Ron, the president phoned leaders in Egypt, Israel, Jordan, and the Palestinian Authority to promise that he will actively engage on Arab-Israeli peace efforts. He is also expected to name former U.S. Senator George Mitchell as his Middle East envoy. Are these the right first steps?
I think they are. I mean, given what we've seen in Gaza and given what we've seen in the Middle East for the last several months, I think this is a very volatile region of the world. It's a region that has very strong geostrategic importance to the United States. And I think it was very wise for him to reach out to these leaders to continue the nonpartisan approach that started with President Bush and President Clinton before him of actively engaging leaders in the Middle East. I mean, this is something that's not a partisan political issue. It's very important for the United States to not only know that let her allies know that we're behind them, but also know that we want to be very much engaged in the peace process, particularly as it pertains to Israel and some of her neighbors in that volatile part of the world.
Let me remind our listeners that you're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. If you're just tuning in with me on today's political roundtable, we have Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Ron Christie, whom you just heard, CEO of Christie Strategies. He is also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Mary, headlines on newspapers and media outlets around the world heralded Obama's inauguration as the chance for a new dialogue with the international community. One of them caught my eye from Al Jazeera in Qatar, talking about how Obama has already reached out to Palestinian leaders over the conflict in Gaza. This is a follow-up to what we were just talking about. What does this signal to you?
Well, it does signal that he is going to attempt to make a new departure here. We had for years a no-talk policy with the Palestinians, and then that changed, and we started talking, and now we have our Palestinians, which is Abbas and Fatah, and their Palestinians are the ones that we don't like, Hamas, who were encouraged to have, the Palestinians had an election encouraged by Bush and Rice, and they elected Hamas. So it's been a mess since then, since we don't like them. I think that what he's saying is he wants to make a new start and talk to everybody who's involved, as he said during the campaign, that he's willing to talk to anybody and listen to anybody and see if he can resolve this conundrum, which has been in politics for all of these years that no one has resolved. But the key to getting some kind of settlement for all of the areas in the Middle East that concern us, and in Iraq and Afghanistan and with the Arab nations everywhere, with Iran, is trying to do something about the Palestinian question.
One last thing in foreign policy, and we'll go back to talk about what's happening in the nation's capital, and it's this. Obama is also meeting with his military leaders. The question is whether drawing down troops from Iraq to send to Afghanistan is the right move at the right time. What are your thoughts about that, Ron?
Well, that's obviously a determination for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and consulting with his various members of the armed forces and consulting with the commander-in-chief, Obama, to make that military decision. I'm always reluctant of moving troops from one battlefield to another unless there's a specific objective and there's a reason for doing so. But, you know, again, I'm willing to give the new president the benefit of the doubt here. He has said that from the day one he wanted to call in the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and talk to the Joint Chiefs about not only our men and women in uniform in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also around the world. So I think it is a good opportunity for him to get a fresh assessment of what the capabilities of the military are and what we need to do to fight and wage and win this war on terrorism.
Let me just say quickly that there are two things here. One is with Iraq. We're forgetting about all the refugees who fled Iraq and who are in Syria and other countries suffering mightily, up in the thousands, some people say millions, many of them Christians, for example. And the fact that the job in Iraq that was started, in my view, inappropriately, hasn't been completed. But also there's another. Sometimes we say we never learn anything from history, but we ought to learn something. Every country that has tried to engage in warfare in Afghanistan and try to defeat the Afghanistan people has failed. This has been true throughout human history. I'm just a little bit concerned, I don't know what the answer is, of how they propose to go about winning in Afghanistan when it hasn't been done before, and a surge, and whether we're going to now get bogged down in Afghanistan. I don't know what the alternatives are, but clearly it's something that I hope they think about very, very carefully.
It would seem, too, that the president would have to, in some way, follow up on his campaign promises to get troops out of Iraq, and perhaps this meeting with the Joint Chiefs will help him to figure out
perhaps
a way to accomplish that, perhaps with a capital P. Let me ask both of you, as Washington insiders, something that also was a part of the president's campaign pledge, which was to sort of reduce the power of lobbyists in the nation's capital. How does a culture, Ron, of the nation's capital change when a new administration comes in? And what happens along K Street where all the lobbyists are located?
You mean how do I go about making my daily living?
Well, I would try not to put you out there like that, but yeah,
Ron is biased on this.
How are you going to survive now?
I have a slight bias. No, I think it's fascinating. I mean, you have nearly 34,000 people who are registered to lobby the federal government, the executive branch, and the legislative branch in Washington. And despite the change in government, despite the change in administration, I think many things will remain the same. Efforts to curtail the amount of money that's in the process have largely failed, in my view. And I think that you'll find a lot of people with a lot of issues and a lot of concerns with the agenda the new president has set forth, who are going to want to hire lobbyists and special interests to make sure that their voices are heard and that in the best way that they can to advance their interests. So many things in Washington change, but many things remain the same. And I think the K Street corridor would be doing quite well for the years to come, for better or worse.
And let me add to that that I think that lobbying is essential, and it's a part of the culture. It's going to continue. I agree with him. Hillary Clinton, I remember in one of the debates, tried to defend lobbying by pointing out that they work, you know, not just for business people, which is fine, but also for things like the nursing association, the dental association, the education people. Everybody has lobbyists. Members of Congress and their staffs get information from lobbyists who collect it. They don't believe everything each lobbyist tells them, but they in fact do collect information. Lobbyists in fact are people who represent most of the people out there in the country who are professionals or belong to anything at all, or unions or whatever. And so the only difference is that there will be slightly more jobs for Democrats. There are always more jobs for whoever's in power. And there may be fewer jobs for Republicans, but there will be some jobs for Republicans because Republicans have enough people to filibuster in the Senate, and they have members, and they make agreements with people on the other side.
Yeah, so but what about safeguards, Ron Christie, in terms of precluding some of the scandalous behavior some lobbyists have been involved with? How's the public going to be protected against that under an Obama administration?
Well, I think the Congress in the last session passed the most comprehensive lobbying reform bill that we've ever seen. Unlike the previous system where you had to file once every 6 months, now lobbyists have to disclose their activities every quarter. And I think that is a very good sense of accountability. I mean, we want to make sure that those who, as Mary aptly points out, have the constitutional right to lobby their government and to work with their government, also have an opportunity to see who they represent and on what issues they're lobbying and perhaps what areas, if there are any to be concerned about, of the influence of money in the system. But I would just remind your listeners, when I worked in the White House and Andy Card was my first chief of staff, he said, "The most noble profession in the world is to be a lobbyist, because to be a good lobbyist is to be a good educator."
But wait, though, Ron. Let's just make sure that we make it clear.
But you only have about 30 seconds
okay,
to do that.
The real problem is that members of Congress and people in the administration do not inappropriately deal with lobbyists, and having people put in jail or kicked out of office, like Ted Stevens and other people, sets a good example for what the constraints ought to be and how careful they ought to be in what they do in their relationships with lobbyists.
That's a good place for us to stop, unfortunately. We'll have to continue that conversation. The real issue is whether or not there is going to be substantive change, and it is just too early to tell that, but we'll find out very, very quickly. Let me thank both of you for coming back again. We always enjoy having you on. Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. She joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington. And Ron Christie, CEO of Christie Strategies. He is also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Barack Obama's inauguration as the nation's new president was greeted with a flurry of internet activity. Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes. He's here to explain. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tony.
So before we take a tour of the reaction in the blogosphere, let's start with our own blog, okay?
All right.
Tell us about the response on News and Views.
Well, let's start with a News and Notes listener named Ernice S. She wrote in our site, "I had chill bumps as I watched the pomp and circumstance, and I swelled with pride as Obama took the oath." To which Jenny K., another News and Notes listener, wrote, "I had no chill bumps other than dread as I watched Obama take the oath. He's a fraud and a fake, and it will take time, but he will soon be outed." And Matthew Scallon summed up the day's events this way. He wrote, "It is possible to have two different thoughts in your head at the same time. One thought is that this country has bridged its racial divide," and then he goes on to write about his disapproval of Obama's support of abortion rights.
I read that they had more video hits on the internet yesterday than ever. Is there a way to determine if they had more internet traffic as well?
There is, actually. Yeah, you can track internet hits by the minute.
You can do that? Okay. Now, you know, as the transition of power was taking place on Capitol Hill, the White House website was also undergoing some changes, correct?
Yeah, the look of the new WhiteHouse.gov mirrors that of Obama's campaign website. It's similar color, similar font, and among the changes, it has a blog, it has a photo slideshow, there's links to President Obama's weekly video addresses, but, you know, there's a limit to the level of user interaction. You can't actually leave comments on the blog, but you can submit your own personal information. And remember that, you know, much was made of how then-candidate Obama used his campaign website to solicit people's email addresses and cell phone numbers, and they had that huge directory. Now the same is true. People can stay connected with the administration, and the administration can sort of wield this directory of supporters as they please.
Now, with all of the stuff that was taking place, I understand that you actually had the time to spend doing an interview with someone who was key in helping Obama in this regard with what we're talking about, the internet. Who was that and what was that?
Yeah, I spoke with Will.i.am. He's the musician and rapper. He's the front man for the group the Black Eyed Peas. And last January, as most people remember, he wrote this song called Yes, We Can. And it fused music with one of Barack Obama's campaign speeches. And the video featured a bunch of celebrities repeating that refrain, Yes, We Can. The video for the song, you know, some people saw that as a pivotal moment in Obama's campaign because it came on the heels of his New Hampshire primary loss to Hillary Clinton, and it helped galvanize his support among young people. So I asked Will.i.am about that video and about its role as a game changer for Obama, and here's what he's had to say.
The person that pointed out the Yes, We Can being a game changer to me was Al Gore. He called me up on the phone and said, hey, Will, it's your buddy Al. I was like, hey, Mr. Gore. He said, call me Al, Will. And he said he really liked Yes, We Can, and he felt that it changed the election. You don't dare to think that. You don't want to think that because you think, like, oh, my gosh, am I being egotistical? But when a person like Al Gore says that, you take it a little bit serious.
And that video has been viewed on YouTube alone about 16 million times.
Really? Yeah. Before we close the chapter on the inauguration, what else do we have on our site for people who want to revisit that moment?
Well, we have some moments from the week's inauguration events as covered by photographer Gil Garcetti. He was on the show yesterday talking about getting that perfect moment on film, and here's some of that.
You try and capture, you know, the moment, because he is a man that connects with the crowd and with the message that he has. So you're looking for that little twinkle in his eye or that little different look that he may have. But frankly, Tony, a lot of my work was gauging the crowd as they were entranced with the day.
Yeah, and he actually managed to get some really good photos.
He did.
Yeah.
You know,
this might
be a good point to remind our viewers about our blog, and let's direct them to how they can get to it. Will you give them the info?
It's simple, nprnewsandviews.org. It's all there.
And we have photographs, obviously, from Garcetti. We have sound. We have a lot of things that you can visit. It keeps you pretty busy.
It does, and I should say we also have a new Speak Your Mind. It's our online series where people write in about the issues they care most about. And we have one today from a woman who wasn't able to attend the inauguration, but she says, it doesn't matter that I wasn't there. That's the name of the post, so that'll be up soon.
Once again, the address?
nprnewsandviews.org.
All right, Jeffrey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes. He joined me here in the studios of NPR West. Now we've got our bloggers roundtable and some of the hot topics they're talking about online. With us, citizen journalist and public policy consultant Faye Anderson. She is founder of Tracking Change, a wiki that will be launched later this month. And LaRue Lewis, assistant professor of sociology and black studies at the City College of New York. He blogs at UptownNotes.com. LaRue, Faye, welcome to News and Notes again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from people across the country about President Barack Obama's inauguration. LaRue, you were in D.C. Faye, you stayed in New York and watched the ceremony at a viewing party at the Schomburg Center. Is there a moment that stood out for either of you? Faye, you first.
Well, actually, Tony, I was locked out of the Schomburg Center.
Oh.
They reached capacity, so I ended up in a better space at the Harlem Armory. So I watched the inauguration with thousands of kids. And I guess the moment that stands out for me was when President Obama, or then President-elect Obama, when he first appeared and the kids just absolutely erupted. And you can see the future on their little faces.
You know, we talked to Robert Smith from NPR earlier in the program about that. He was also at that event. LaRue, talk about something that stood out for you.
Well, the temperature was absolutely freezing in D.C., and I know people were really cold, and we were waiting for the inauguration to get going. And when Barack Obama started to come down the stairs, his image was projected on the Jumbotron, and all of almost the complaining and the bustling froze for a moment as he walked down. His confidence was exuding when he was taking on what's fundamentally almost an impossible task, but it just seemed like the transition in power had occurred, and everyone snapped to attention in a really powerful manner.
You know, one of the things that seems to be heating up on the blogosphere from what we're hearing here at News and Notes is the benediction as delivered by Reverend Joseph Lowery yesterday. Here it is, if you missed it.
We ask you to help us work for that day when black will not be asked to get back, when brown can stick around, when yellow will be mellow, when the red man can get ahead, man, and when white will embrace what is right. Let all those who do justice and love mercy say amen.
Amen.
Say amen,
amen.
And amen.
Amen.
Now, on the blog, some people are giving a number of different points of view, one saying that, quote, why weren't Lowery's racist comments allowed to, why were they allowed to taint this historic event, and who are these yellow and red people he's talking about? Another says it's day one of the Obama presidency, and the race card already has been played. Mr. Lowery, may we look to you to direct us to what is right. Faye, what did you think when you heard it, and what have you been seeing in the blogs?
Well, I've seen what you just said. Let me say, I know Reverend Lowery very well, and frankly, I was a little bit disappointed with his benediction, not because of any racial implications, but, you know, it was a historic, momentous occasion, and that's a schoolyard taunt that every black child knows. And so Dr. Lowery is old school, and I had hoped that he would have risen to the occasion. But I think it's a reflection of black culture. There'll be very few black people who don't know what Reverend Lowery was talking about.
You share that?
It goes more to intra-racial politics dynamics than as much to interracial dynamics as it does to black-white.
I'm following you. LaRue, what were your thoughts?
I think I'm probably on the opposite end of the spectrum. I think Reverend Lowery is old school, and I appreciate his the tradition he's coming from. When he opened up with Lift Every Voice and Sing, that was the first invocation of race. We are in an era when people are willing to look past race quickly, but race has always been at the forefront of this campaign, whether it's said or unsaid. So when Reverend Lowery brought up Lift Every Voice and Sing, and in the end, when he ended with the homily that was about race relations, this is him signaling to folks, even though this is a powerful, transformative moment, it is not an ahistorical moment. Let's remember history and responsibility that we all have for changing America.
Let's talk for a moment, if we can, about how far Barack Obama's presidency relates to the issue of changing perceptions of black Americans. Some see it as, I've heard people say, we're standing taller, we're straighter, we're prouder, and I've heard others say that this isn't going to change a single thing. Faye, how are you interpreting it, and what are you reading in the blogs in terms of how people across the country are looking at that particular issue?
You know what, Tony? I've been surprised, well, not shocked, surprised. How many times I've read in the last few days that, well, Obama, he's not the first black president. He's the first biracial president, the first mixed-race president. Anything other than he's the first black or African-American president. So I think whites want to see it as post-racial, but certainly blacks are not buying into it. And again, looking at those thousands of kids and what must be going, yesterday at the Harlem Armory, what must have been going through their minds that their first president, for practical purposes, is a black man and the possibilities it opens up for them. So I think it would be very hard to look at black folks in the same way. And just to finish, that I've read on, I forgot, on whose blog, about rappers, that they have to clean up their act. How are you going to talk about the B word and assume that pimp persona with a black man in the White House?
Is it not palpable, LaRue, the sense that something has changed between blacks and whites since Obama's candidacy and now his election and ascension to the presidency? Although the question, I suppose, remains, how long will it last?
Yeah, I think there is a noticeable change in the orientations towards folks. Now, the biggest thing is that Barack Obama is exceptional, right? He is a cut above almost every human being that we see in terms of intellect, in terms of confidence, in terms of political ability. What I think this moment we have to look to is making sure that not only do perceptions about Barack Obama shift, but perceptions about everyday African Americans. Ironically, I was in D.C., and right after midnight, I was trying to catch a taxi in D.C. and waited outside for 30 minutes as cabs passed me by and by. I want to see a transformation that every person who's black, brown, yellow, red, whomever, that they're treated with respect and dignity like we now treat the President of the United States.
I would just add, Obama's exceptionalism, if he were to show up at, let's say, Penn Station without his Secret Service detail, he would still have trouble catching a cab.
You know, either of you see Barack Obama as a civil rights president, do you?
No, but he has an obligation as president to enforce civil rights laws.
Certainly, but do you see this as an issue for him?
I see it as a major issue. I don't see him as a civil rights president. As folks have said time and time again, Barack Obama can't be, quote unquote, the president of black America. With that being said, I think it's important for the civil rights community, people of color, to redefine the role to the president and say, with presidents before, we've had to push and make sure our voices are heard. We have to take that on even more now because there's a willingness to try to push race, gender, sexuality off the agenda. We have to push it back on, even though we have a candidate who may look like us or may come from some of the same circles. That doesn't mean that he'll act on our behalf.
We're going to pursue this point even further here at News and Notes, probably on Thursday, if not in the very near future. Let me move on to one last point before we end our conversation. It has to do, since you are all bloggers, technology, because technology played a significant role in the 2008 presidential race. Obama successfully using mobile technology, the web, social networking sites to reach out to voters. Do you think and feel that that will continue through his presidency, Faye?
Oh, absolutely. I sure hope so. That's why I'm launching Tracking Change Wiki later this month. As was mentioned earlier, if you go to change.gov, now whitehouse.gov, you see that a lot of the features from change.gov is there. And if citizens want to participate in the policy-making process, they are going to have to use these online tools.
Now, during the campaign, just to follow that point a little bit further, LaRue, the president, the candidate at the time, was reaching out to people to raise money and to mobilize voters. Are they still reaching out in the same way with the same intensity at the moment?
I would think, much to a lot of people's chagrin, they are. Emails are still coming out. There are updates constantly about what's happening, which is great. So it gives you a chance to update, as well as the blogosphere can respond with critique. And you get a chance for new innovations, right? What are people thinking? What are the technologies we use to connect with the American public? So they have done a good job in the past, and I look forward to them updating their strategy as his presidency unfolds.
Let me thank both of you for coming on. Having bloggers talk about blogging is always fascinating. We appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have been talking with LaRue Lewis, Assistant Professor of Sociology and Black Studies at the City College of New York. His blog is UptownNotes.com. And citizen journalist and public policy consultant Faye Anderson, her wiki Tracking Change launches later this month. Both were at our New York studios. Now, you can find their links to their blogs and to ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop there. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues that you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind.